An anniversary this week, folks. 18 years, believe it or not, since the terrorist attacks on 9/11. Wow. We have a great story to tell you. Well, it's actually a great story told by our guest who visits with us by telephone, Garrett Graff, who has written a story that you probably have not heard before about the attacks. First of all, let's say hello to our guest. Garrett, nice to have you with us for a few minutes here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You have written a book entitled The Only Plane in the Sky, An Oral History of 9/11. And this has to deal with what happened to the president during the hours immediately following the attack. This story has never really been told in detail, has it?
Yeah, so this started as a look at the being aboard Air Force One on 9/11 with the president, and ultimately grew into this book, which is the story of the entire country told through the voices of the people who experienced 9/11, 480 Americans from Shanksville and Pittsburgh to New York City and the Pentagon, air traffic controllers, fighter pilots, and passengers and crew aboard both the hijacked planes and just regular planes in the air. So it's trying to capture the whole national experience on 9/11.
You obviously had to talk to, I would guess, hundreds of people to get the information for your book, Garrett.
Yes. So it's partially based on my own interviews, as well as some incredible work done by institutions like the Flight 93 National Memorial there, which has its own great oral history collection that I was able to tap for the stories of the volunteers and first responders and the Pittsburgh air traffic controllers who helped keep our country safe and respond to the unprecedented tragedy of Flight 93.
We are in Butler, Pennsylvania, which is a bedroom community of Pittsburgh just north of this city. And we didn't know it at the time, but it turns out that doomed Flight 93 passed right over us, right over Butler County, before crashing, of course, in Shanksville near Somerset. Wow, just talking about this again, it brings back so many memories for any American of a certain age who is alive. It's going to be one of those things that they'll remember, Garrett, for the rest of their lives, where they were at that exact moment that they heard about all this.
Absolutely, and that's part of the reason that I wanted to write this book, is that, as you mentioned, this is the 18th anniversary of 9/11, and that ends up being a surprisingly momentous one, because we have this shift as a country that we are experiencing of 9/11 moving from memory to history, that this is the fall where the first college class born after 9/11 is starting at college. You're beginning to see American servicemen and women born after 9/11 who have enlisted in the military and are deploying this year for the first time to Iraq and Afghanistan, the wars spawned by the events of 9/11. And even in New York City, this year will mark the first time that people born after 9/11 are eligible to apply to join the New York City Fire Department. And so the goal of this book is to try to tell the story at a national level, both for those who remember it as well as for a new generation who live every day in the world shaped by 9/11 but have no memories of it themselves.
Let's talk a little bit about the title of your book, The Only Plane in the Sky. Obviously, there are going to be younger listeners who might not know what you're talking about there, Garrett Graff. Where does the title come from?
So the title is comes from a quote about the President's Day. President Bush, as people likely remember, was in Sarasota, Florida that day, reading at an elementary school, and was hustled aboard Air Force One in the moments after the attacks on New York City and the Pentagon, and spent the day hopscotching across the country to secure military bases until late that afternoon when they were finally sure that it was safe for him to return to Washington. And so by late afternoon, after all of the planes had been grounded in the country, President Bush and his fighter plane escort on their way back to Washington was effectively the only plane in the sky.
Mm. Yeah, we forget about that. And by the way, we also forget that at this time, George W. Bush was a fairly untested president. He was relatively new in office, was he not?
He was. And you know, this is sort of part of this story is how this was a major transition point for President Bush and his presidency. I mean, remember, he had a shortened transition period because of the dispute Bush v. Gore over the 2000 recount in Florida. And he was really still settling into the office. One of the things that really struck me when I was talking to people who were with him and around him that day was they remember in Sarasota, Florida, the protesters who were lining the streets in Sarasota protesting the Florida recount still. You know, this was one of the president's first trips back to Florida at the time after becoming president, and he was just a couple of months into his administration and still settling in with his staff and still getting to know the office. And I talked to Andy Card, the White House chief of staff, who told me that he, remember Andy Card was the person who went up and whispered in President Bush's ear in that classroom, "America is under attack," and that he thinks that President Bush realized in that moment that this is what the presidency is about, that it wasn't about the other priorities of the president, but keeping the nation safe in a time of crisis. That's the point of the presidency.
So why didn't they hustle President Bush immediately back to Washington, Garrett?
It's a really interesting question, because if you remember, the media at the time really criticized the president for not coming back to Washington. But frankly, they just weren't sure that the president himself was not a target. There was a fear that there was a terror plot that could be targeting the president and Air Force One. We forget this now, but until about 3:15 that afternoon, there was still a fear that there were hijacked planes in the air over the United States. It took several hours for them to ground all of the planes, and until they were sure that the president was safe or could be safe back in Washington, they wanted to keep him away from the Capitol. I mean, again, sort of one of the things that we forget is that the first reports and the first rumors of the downing of Flight 93 was that it had crashed near Camp David, which, of course, is not all that far from Shanksville, although we certainly know that United 93 was not targeting Camp David. But they feared that that was actually an attack on the president, that that Flight 93 had been trying to hit the president at Camp David. And so there was a real concern about whether the president could be safe.
And we don't know for sure, at least to my knowledge, where Flight 93 was headed by the hijackers. Speculation is either the U.S. Capitol building or Washington, D.C. Obviously, once the hijackers turned it around, it was headed for D.C. somewhere.
Exactly. And I talk about I sort of follow people through both the bunker under the White House, which is where Dick Cheney and other top aides were hustled and kept safe over the course of the day, as well as people on Capitol Hill, both of whom, really feared at that time that there were hijacked planes coming to hit them. I talk about and quote in the book, you know, the Secret Service agents standing post at the White House, who the supervisor of the Joint Operations Center said at the time, if we're hit, anybody who survives go to the alternate command center. And it wasn't meant as a joke. It was that was actually their belief, was that many of them would not actually survive that day.
Wow. We'll take a quick break. We have a few more minutes to chat with our guest, Garrett Graff, here on It's Your Turn on WISR. We'll be right back.